I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. North Korea claims it detonated a hydrogen bomb on Sunday, capping off a summer of nuclear saber-rattling. While that claim has not been verified, the blast caused tremors that were felt in China and South Korea. Secretary of Defense James Mattis said this on Sunday.
Any threat to the United States or its territories, including Guam, or our allies, will be met with a massive military response, a response both effective and overwhelming.
UN Ambassador Nikki Haley had these tough words for North Korea yesterday, speaking in an emergency session of the Security Council. This clip is lightly edited.
The time for half measures in the Security Council is over. The time has come to exhaust all of our diplomatic means before it's too late. We must now adopt the strongest possible measures. His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war.
President Trump tweeted the U.S. is considering stopping trade with countries doing business with North Korea and criticized South Korea for what he called their talk of appeasement, saying North Korea only understands one thing. We asked Joe Cirincione to join us. He's president of the Plowshares Fund. That's a global security foundation that promotes the elimination of nuclear weapons. He wrote a book called Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late. Joe Cirincione, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. What do we know about this bomb?
Well, all the evidence is consistent with the explosion of a true hydrogen bomb. The seismic signature of around 6.0 on the Richter scale would indicate an explosion of at least 100,000 tons of TNT, the equivalent of 100,000 tons. That would make it 10 times larger than the explosion that North Korea conducted just last year. It could be more, could be several hundred thousand tons, even a megaton, a million tons. And this would indicate a true hydrogen bomb. The design that was revealed in the photos that North Korea released indicates what's called a two-stage thermonuclear device, a small atomic bomb that is set off that then ignites hydrogen isotopes that are fused together. That's consistent with the U.S. and other designs for hydrogen bombs. And all this is well within North Korea's technical capability. So at this point, I don't see much reason to doubt that Kim Jong-un has the hydrogen bomb.
Does that make North Korea then a nuclear power?
Well, they were already a nuclear power before that. They've conducted five tests. Usually when countries have conducted five tests in history, they have pretty advanced designs. So, but we would call those previous bombs fission bombs, atomic bombs, the kind and size that we dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A hydrogen bomb is another leap forward. The United States and the Soviets, for example, and the Russians, rather, we all have hydrogen bombs. We don't play around with small atomic bombs anymore. We all have bombs in this 100,000-ton category. Kim Jong-un now joins, five other countries that we believe have hydrogen bombs: the U.S., Russia, China, France, and the United Kingdom all field hydrogen bombs, and now North Korea.
Do we know whether Kim and North Korea, are they interested in having these kinds of weapons for offensive reasons? They certainly have been very bellicose about it. But are there also defensive reasons that at least Kim feels he needs to have this kind of firepower?
Well, all atomic weapons are sort of intrinsically offensive. They are designed to cause mass destruction, killing of hundreds of thousands of people, destruction of vast quantities of buildings and material. But every country that has these weapons says that they're for defensive purposes only, that they are to deter another country from attacking them. And that is most likely what Kim Jong-un wants. That is, he doesn't want to build a bomb to do a bolt out of the blue attack. He's not going to build a weapon and then launch it just for the sake of what? Destroying Seattle, destroying Los Angeles?
That's
won't
suicide,
do that is
isn't
he knows
it?
What happened. It's suicide. He knows what would happen next. And that's what Secretary Mattis was driving home just the other day with his statement, that any attack in the United States or our allies would be met with massive retaliation. So this deterrence works both ways. We deter Kim Jong-un from attacking us with the threat of a massive response, and he believes that these weapons are the massive response he needs to deter the United States from attacking him.
So do we need to just get used to living with a nuclear-powered North Korea? And I'm thinking about both of what Mattis said, what the president has said, what Nikki Haley has said, and it seems as if we could be on the precipice of some kind of, if not warfare, a more serious conflict.
I am sighing because it is a very difficult situation. So there's two parts. This is the debate that is now happening in my expert circles, in foreign capitals. Do we have to accept a nuclear-armed North Korea? Is this now the reality? And I think the answer, unfortunately, is yes. I think that the policies of the last 20 years, where we could have cut a deal, we could have reached an agreement, we were very close at the end of the Clinton administration, for example, at getting an agreement that would permanently roll back North Korea's program, that we had gotten an agreement that stopped their production of plutonium, an agreement that had stopped their testing of missiles. But unfortunately, when the Bush administration came in, they rejected that path. We sort of lost the opportunity. Every time we try to go back to negotiations, it's been harder. The price has been higher. And so at this point, it seems that Kim Jong-un is not going to give up his weapons. It's hard to imagine any deal where he would be convinced to give up the weapons he has spent so much time to build. So at best, you're looking at a deal that might freeze the program. Might freeze the program and stop new testing, maybe the new production of even more weapons. If we had made this kind of deal a couple of years ago, we would have stopped the intercontinental ballistic missile, so he now has missiles that can reach the United States. We could have stopped the hydrogen bomb. We did not. The longer we wait to negotiate a deal, the higher the price.
But has the United States been drawing one line in the sand after the other that then North Korea moves beyond?
Yes. He's blown through Donald Trump's red lines like they were tissue paper. You remember Fire and Fury.
But
after that, he shot off an intercontinental ballistic missile. This is the problem with this kind of bluster of foreign policy, this kind of empty threats, or even the Nikki Haley quote, enough is enough. We've reached the end of the road. What does that mean? We haven't. We're not going to go to war to stop North Korea. We're not going to do a preemptive attack, even though there are some in the United States who want that. So the problem we now have is we have an empty, almost incoherent policy at the United States, and that's the risk. If you keep having a policy that's bluster without real consequence, that issues empty threats, and Kim Jong-un keeps advancing, at some point you run the risk that a President Trump is going to feel that he has to act, either to maintain his own credibility or to detract attention from his mounting domestic difficulties. And so the greatest fear that I and many other experts have is that we are going to stumble into war, that an act is going to take place, whether on Kim Jong-un's part or President Trump's part, that is going to escalate into military exchanges that will spiral up into a full-fledged conventional war in the Korean Peninsula. And that will be a conflict unlike anything we've seen since the end of World War II. The Korean Peninsula is the most heavily militarized area on Earth. There are enough conventional weapons there to kill several hundred thousand people in just the first few hours of combat. So it's
frightening.
Quite a serious situation.
It's frightening. I mean, South Korea has talked about talks. The president said that's appeasement from his perspective. But I'm thinking about if there were talks with North Korea, what would they talk about? What would be negotiated? What would be on the table for discussion?
Well, North Korea has indicated that they're willing to talk, and they've repeatedly made offers to discuss a freeze in their program. What they want in exchange is a freeze on U.S. and South Korean military exercises. They see these exercises, we just completed 2 weeks of them at the end of August, as practice runs for an invasion of North Korea. And they're not wrong. That is, in fact, some of the exercises are practicing what we call decapitation strikes on North Korea. We think of them as defensive, that we're saying, if you invade us, we're going to be ready. But the North Koreans see them as offensive. That's what they want to end, and they're willing to talk that. The U.S. hasn't been willing to do that. Hmm. We don't want to trade what we think of as legitimate, conventional military deterrence for an end to their illegitimate nuclear program. And so we've placed conditions on our talks. We're not willing to talk to North Korea unless the purpose of those talks is the dismantlement of North Korea's nuclear program. They're not willing to talk under those conditions, hence no talks.
Only a couple minutes, and I have a couple of questions. How effective do you think sanctions either are or could be if they were made even tougher?
Sanctions can be very effective, but they're an incentive for negotiations. Sanctions alone have never forced a country into capitulation or collapse. So it's not a silver bullet. It's a tool. There has to be a negotiations in there somewhere. That's what China's saying. That's what South Korea's saying. The U.S. hopefully will come around to this position and be willing to use the incentives of sanctions to get a good deal at the bargaining table.
What about a Stuxnet-type cyber strike or cyber attack? Is that a possibility?
The New York Times has reported that the U.S. has been trying cyber attacks. Maybe that resulted in some missile failures, but it hasn't shown up recently. Remember, the North Koreans are very good at cyber warfare. Their attack on Sony Pictures, for example, demonstrated that. And they're also very good at cyber defense. So I'm sure that there's a certain level of cyber warfare that's going on, but so far it hasn't been enough to put a serious dent in North Korea's programs.
Your book is called Nuclear Nightmares. Is this a nuclear nightmare?
It certainly is, and it's what happens when you don't make serious efforts to get rid of nuclear weapons. As long as the big powers still have them, some of the little powers are going to try and get them.
And do you think North Korea, I mean, based on past behavior, that there will be another test of some kind of a nuclear weapon soon?
Absolutely. There's no reason for Kim Jong-un to stop now. He has other missile designs he wants to test. They've said they're going to do another test perhaps on September 9th. That's their foundation day, their commemoration of the founding of the Democratic People's Republic. So I would expect more ICBM tests over Japan, flying directly over Japan. I would expect more nuclear tests. This program is going to continue until there's a negotiated agreement to stop it.
On that note, Joe Cirincione, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Such a serious topic. You're very welcome. And he's the president of the Plowshares Fund. That's a global security foundation and author of a book called Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late. After a short break, we'll be talking with Reed Wilson from The Hill and Rosie Gray from The Atlantic about what's on the table in Washington, D.C. as Congress returns from its August vacation. Much to discuss. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Congress is back from their August recess today with a lot on their plate, most critically how to help the victims of Hurricane Harvey. The White House has called for almost $8 billion. That's a drop in the bucket considering the extent of the damage. Equally pressing is what Congress will do when the president is expected to end DACA today. That's the Obama program that protects some 800,000 undocumented immigrants from deportation who were brought to this country when they were children. His decision reportedly won't take effect for 6 months, thereby putting the ball in Congress's court. Donald Trump has sent mixed messages about these so-called dreamers as a candidate and as president.
We love the dreamers. We love everybody.
Anyone who has entered the United States illegally is subject to deportation.
The DACA situation is a very, very, it's a very difficult thing for me because, you know, I love these kids.
We will immediately terminate President Obama's
two illegal executive amnesties.
We are going to deal with DACA with heart.
I want dreamers to come from the United States. I want the people in the United States that have children. I want them to have dreams also. We're always talking about dreamers for other people. I want the children that are growing up in the United States to be dreamers also. They're not dreaming right now.
Well, here to talk about all of this and other legislative issues is Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, and he joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Reed Wilson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times today.
Hey, Marty.
Also with us is Rosie Gray, and she's White House correspondent for The Atlantic, joining us by telephone. Rosie Gray, nice to have you with us as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Reed, let me begin with you and also begin with what looks like an announcement from Attorney General Sessions sometime this morning, perhaps about 11 o'clock, about this DACA program. What is the pressure that is driving the White House and the president to make this decision today?
The pressure is what you just played. You showed, went through the comments that the president has made over the last, you know, since he basically started running for president, about ending this program, about ending illegal immigration and the executive amnesty programs that President Obama put into effect. The question is, what does he get from it, though? Right. It's not entirely clear that he has the sort of plan to come up with some kind of solution to something that's a massive problem. There are 800,000 of these DACA recipients in the U.S. They are, you know, altar boys and crossing guards and college graduates and military members and things like that. Are we really going to deport all of these people? He has just thrown the ball to Congress without actually setting out any kind of goal about what he wants in the long run. That's going to be a big political problem for him going forward.
And, Rosie, it's interesting that it'll be not the president today, but apparently the Attorney General Sessions who will be making whatever this announcement is. What's the significance of that?
Well, it could show that President Trump doesn't really want to be actually the face of this decision. And that kind of ties into the fact that he's planning to include a sort of six-month deferment, which, you know, indicates that on some level he probably wants to, you know, shift off some of the sort of backlash decision onto Congress.
And sort of wipe his hands of this obviously difficult decision?
Right. And, you know, like Reed was saying, there is not actually a ton of there's not actually a ton of benefit for President Trump in ending this program. And, you know, it's sort of it's part of this pattern that he's shown of kind of, you know, doing away with Obama era policies just because he wants, just because they're Obama era policies, basically, and because he may have made certain promises during the campaign, but then not actually using them sort of for political leverage.
Well, I mean, obviously, this is something that his base wanted. Stephen Miller, apparently, Rosie, has been influential, Sessions as well. And I wonder whether Bannon, he might not be working in the White House. Is he talking to the president? Do we know?
Well, Steve Bannon, I mean, despite the fact that he's outside the White House, you know, is still an influential figure sort of in Trump world. And he is somebody who, you know, when he was in the administration was you know, influential, obviously, on these immigration fights. He has, since leaving the White House, I think, spoken at times with the president. That's been reported. But he actually, when he was on the inside, wanted to kind of use DACA as, you know, as leverage as opposed to just sort of doing away with it.
Oh, interesting.
You know, just doing away with it altogether. So this is the approach that's being taken right now is not necessarily exactly what Steve Bannon had advocated for when he was there.
Reed, it's interesting. I mean, you've got Ryan who said, you know, don't rescind this program. Other members of Congress saying, don't rescind this program. You've got business leaders. You've got university leaders. I mean, he has set up this really interesting showdown even within his own Republican Party.
And I think a part of the reason that Ryan and some of these other members of Congress, including, by the way, some very conservative members like Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma, have said not to repeal or pull back this program, is that now the ball is in Congress's court, and Congress is having some really difficult times actually passing something. I mean, this throws an immigration debate into a Republican-led Congress, a Congress that has struggled with immigration for the last 2 decades, effectively. I mean, basically since Ronald Reagan was president. Now they are going to have to deal with it again. It is something that divides the House Republican Conference. It's something that divides some senators from their Senate leadership as well. And that is a big problem for them. Suddenly, it's their responsibility to fix this, or 800,000 people, a lot of whom have very sympathetic stories, who are going to be on the front pages of every newspaper across the country, are going to get deported.
Is that enough, you think, to pressure Congress into at least making some kind of at least moderately humane decision on this?
This Congress has shown again and again that they really only act when their backs are up against the wall. I'm sure we're going to talk about the debt ceiling and the budget that has to pass in the next couple of weeks. There's another example, you know, something that could have been dealt with in June or July is only now being dealt with as the clock ticks away. Well, maybe this is, you know, setting a clock is at least one way of forcing action that Congress has responded to in the past.
I mean, Rosie, Congress was not able to pass the DREAM Act. This went back to 2010, which is one of the reasons that President Obama issued this executive order to protect these children who were brought here when their parents came in as undocumented immigrants. But executive orders can be undone. And this is, I guess, the risk of doing legislation, of doing executive order instead of legislation.
Well, you know, if you'll remember, you know, one of the sort of running themes of the Obama administration was that he did start to kind of rely on executive orders because it was so hard to work with Congress and for Congress to work with itself to really get anything done. And I mean, that has basically continued into the Trump administration. I mean, if you look at the administration's like legislative priorities for this year, very little of it has actually gotten done. And we're already past the August recess. So they have a ton that they have to, that they're supposed to be doing this month. And like Reid said, you know, unless you sort of give them a deadline, it's hard for them to actually come to an agreement on anything. You know, the Republicans are very divided on certain issues. The Democrats are loath to work with them on, you know, anything that President Trump wants, really. So, you know, I don't, it doesn't necessarily seem that, that, you know, for example, tax reform and other big ticket items on the Trump legislative agenda are going to get done, you know, soon.
That is Rosie Gray. She's White House correspondent for The Atlantic. Also with us, Reid Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. We invited both of them to join us on Radio Times to talk about a busy couple of weeks or a couple of months for the U.S. Congress back from their August recess today. And again, to use a cliche, a lot on their plate. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. What are you hoping, expecting your Congress to do or our Congress to do? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Reid, is there any evidence that Hurricane Harvey has or will change the political either calculations or agenda in Congress in that this is a true emergency, a true crisis?
I don't see evidence that this has changed the sort of fundamental underlying conflict that exists in Congress that has driven them to a standstill for so many years. It is likely that it will force some action. We just talked about the putting people's backs against the wall and requiring action. Well, here's a major American city that's underwater. There's going to be an aid package. It looks like about a $7.9 billion aid package that'll fund FEMA only through the end of the month, which means that there's going to be more spending to come. This is going to cost the American taxpayers a substantial amount of money, just as Hurricane Katrina did to so many years ago. it will force some action in the short term. Whether it changes anything in the long run, no, I don't think so. I hate to be such a pessimist, but the fundamental underlying reasons that Congress is so divided will not be shaken by even by a storm of this magnitude.
I noticed that Senator Cruz and Governor Christie sort of reliving the fight that they had over Sandy relief, and Ted Cruz won, and others wanting to offset some of that money with cuts. Do you think, Reid, that'll come up this session at all?
It will come up, but I don't think that that's going to slow down this bill at all. That was something that Republicans did when a storm hit a blue state, and they had a Democratic president who they really didn't like. Now they've got a Republican president who wants this money quickly, and he's got some people like the Office of Management and Budget head Mick Mulvaney, who used to be a member of the very conservative Freedom Caucus, pushing for this money. So I don't think that's going to hold up the immediate passage, but it will certainly come up, and it's going to be a part of this delicate dance between the, call them the establishment faction of the Republican Party in Congress, and this ultra-conservative Freedom Caucus. Together, they equal a majority in Congress, but neither is sufficient for a majority in and of themselves. Democrats are never going to go along with something that adds new cuts to an aid package. So Republicans, the establishment Republicans, can work with Democrats to come up with a clean bill. I think that's what we're most likely to see come out this week.
Rosie, who are the president's allies in the U.S. Congress?
I think he has some fans, you know, in the House Freedom Caucus, and, you know, elsewhere in, you know, and, you know, none of the Republicans in Congress have, besides, you know, sort of some notable dissenters like Jeff Flake, have really, you know, kind of officially turned on him. But, I mean, President Trump, one of the things that has really marked this presidency has been his extremely fraught relationship with the people who are supposed to be his allies in Congress and the people who
like
he
McConnell.
Is supposed to be. Well, exactly. I mean, like, the Republican congressional leadership. I mean, one of the things that's been sort of striking about this administration so far is that despite the fact that the Republican Party controls both the White House and both houses of Congress, that they've sort of not been able to get so much of what they wanted to get done. And part of that is because President Trump just has very poor relationships with Republican leaders in Congress.
Let me read something that John McCain actually wrote in the Washington Post headline. It's time Congress returns to regular order. He complained about the dysfunction in Congress, the perpetual campaign, the gridlock. But then he goes on to say, and I'll put this to you, Reid, Congress must govern with a president who has no experience of public office, is often poorly informed, and can be impulsive in his speech and conduct. We must respect his authority and constitutional responsibilities. We must, where we can, cooperate with him, but we are not his subordinates. We don't answer to him. We answer to the American people. And he goes on from there. Do those words, Reid, does John McCain represent an important faction within the Senate or within Congress?
I think this is a hint about the most interesting sort of long-term change happening under the Trump administration. Basically, since the Watergate era, power has been bleeding from one side of Pennsylvania Avenue where Congress sits to the other side where the White House is. The president has become a more and more powerful figure. Barack Obama used the office much more than George W. Bush did, who used it more than Bill Clinton. The trappings of executive authority have become a larger and larger factor. Now we have a president who does not have the experience in governing, is seemingly unable to grasp the ability to work those executive functions, and therefore power is kind of bleeding the other way. For the first time in 50 years, we've seen Congress taking up more of their own own agenda and pushing it themselves. Now, it hasn't led to real results yet, but they're doing it. And, you know, this is something something that is really only possible because President Trump is the president. He came into office with a very small number of agenda items: build a border wall, pull out of TPP, renegotiate trade deals. That's about it. Right. If Jeb Bush had been elected president, or Marco Rubio, or Ted Cruz, or anybody like that, they would have come into office with binders of 500 pages of policy proposals for the Department of Education and Interior and every government agency there is. They would have had plans for all of these things that these agencies could do. Because Trump came in with little experience in government, no experience in government, he has not pushed that same kind of agenda that has given Congress a power that I think they were a little reluctant to seize at the beginning, but now that Trump's approval ratings are in the tank and he has proven sort of unable to really wrap his mind around his arms around the powers of the executive, I think now Congress is taking up that power. Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan are much more powerful under a President Trump than they would have been under a President Jeb or President Rubio.
Oh, that's so interesting. Rosie, speaking of a border wall, what is the status of that? And is the president still as enthusiastic about that now that obviously there are budgetary considerations?
Well, last month at that rally in Phoenix, President Trump threatened to, basically said that he was willing to shut down the government over border wall funding, and he backed away from that, which indicates that at the end of the day, he's not willing to go sort of fully to the mat for it. It does, obviously this is like one of his signature campaign promises, and I do think that on some level at least, there are going to be efforts to secure the funding for the wall, for kind of as long as it takes. And he did promise that Mexico would pay for the wall. Mm-hmm. Obviously, over time, we've seen
Mexico said they would not pay for the wall.
Well, right, and if you look at the transcript of President Trump's call earlier this year with the Mexican president, they basically sort of say that to each other, that, President Trump kind of admits that politically he had to say this and that that's not actually really how it's going to kind of go. The wall, I think, is something that's going to be sort of a feature of the agenda for a long time. I don't necessarily see the construction of the actual wall happening anytime soon.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Rosie Gray. She's White House correspondent for The Atlantic, joining us by telephone. Reed Wilson, down in the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., he's national correspondent for The Hill. And we are talking about the fraying relationship between the president and Congress, also the many things that Congress is grappling with as they return from their August vacation. And you can join our conversation. We want to know what you want our Congress to do. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Here's an email from Peter. How much time and money will it take to deport 750,000 DACA immigrants on top of those we already deport? How many legal immigrants and U.S. citizens will be caught up in a sweep? I'm not sure we have the exact answer to that, but to you, Reed, if you're a member of DACA, the government knows a lot about you because you essentially had to register with the government in order to get that, I guess, those protections.
Yeah, and think about how this plays out over the long run. President Trump is doing something that will appeal to his core base. But then again, his core base is not just the people who voted for him. It's the people who are actively supporting him and stand behind him. That may be a pretty small number of Americans, 30% maybe. Mm-hmm. And we'll see where his approval rating bottoms out at some point. But on the other hand, not only do we have the members who we mentioned, Paul Ryan, James Lankford, these very conservative members of Congress arguing against rolling back the DACA program. We also have the stories that are going to play out when ICE agents raid a church to deport an altar boy or a valedictorian or something like that. These stories exist among the 800,000 DACA recipients in the U.S., and they're going to be highlighted on the front page of every single newspaper. Now, it may be the Trump administration's hope that when we think about DACA, we're thinking about MS-13 and gang violence and the administration's efforts to crack down on crime.
But they're not protected under DACA, right?
That's right. So if we're thinking about that, great, this is a political advantage to them. But the fact is there are 800,000 people who are not convicted of any crime or anything like that who came here when they were 4 and 5 and, 6 months old. Mm-hmm. These are not people who made their own choice to come here, and they have lived successful lives, and now we're going to take that away from them. If those are the front page stories across the country over the next several months or years, boy, this thing is going to be a very bad political deal for the president.
You know, Rosie, this was, I guess, floated in the last couple of days that that announcement is going to be made sometime today, perhaps even this morning. Is there any question about the president and his position on DACA? Do we know? Are we pretty certain that this program will be rescinded as far as the president is concerned, or at least tossed over to Congress?
Well, I don't think that is 100% certain. And I think part of the move to sort of, dump this on Congress and sort of have a 6 month window here is that it does sort of, leave the window a little bit open for not necessarily at the end of the day ending it entirely. In terms of what President Trump himself actually feels about it, the clips that you were playing earlier showed, he has gone back and forth on DACA, and he has shown some level of sympathy for the DACA recipients,
right.
While also at the same time saying that, anyone who has entered the country illegally is subject to deportation. So I do think that, his past statements show that he is on some level, torn a bit on this issue.
I mean, I think one of the questions is it ambivalence or is it confusion, or did he back himself into his own corner here because he was so outspokenly critical, at least as a candidate, Rosie, on this particular issue?
Well, I do think that he has backed himself into a corner on it, and I think that this isn't the only thing that he's done that with. I mean, the wall is another example of something that, he repeatedly promised without necessarily thinking the whole thing through. During the campaign, he started promising that they would build the wall, and then, the sort of mechanism for it and the actual kind of policy idea was sort of retroactively applied. So this isn't the first time that he's sort of said things that have made it so he has to kind of back them up with action. And so it does seem like he's sort of cornered himself on this.
Reid, let me go back to you, and let's talk a bit about the debt ceiling and the budget. I mean, these are some of the other big ticket.
Well, the easy stuff.
Exactly, the easy stuff that Congress has to wrestle with. Is there any question about raising or not raising the debt ceiling?
No. The only question is how is this going to play out among the conservative faction within the House Republican Conference? They want to see some kind of cuts or something like that that would accompany a debt ceiling increase. That's pretty unlikely, and as a matter of fact, it's even possible that we could see a clean debt ceiling increase pass the House, go to the Senate where they could add funding for Hurricane Harvey recovery, then it would go back to the House and a coalition of Dems and Republicans could actually pass it.
Wow.
They have to act by September 29th. That's when the Treasury Department says they'll run out of the accounting gimmicks that they can employ to put off the debt ceiling. And by the way, they've also got a spending bill that they have to pass by September 30th to keep the government open. So all of this could roll into one nice, neat little package. That being said, the way Congress has worked lately, it isn't always the case that they've been able to do that. And if I could go back to
sure.
one point that Rosie made that I
sure.
thought was smart, the president is a deal maker. He's always been he's fashioned himself as this the art of the deal, the guy who is able to put together these big mega deals. Well, it turns out that making deals in business is much different from making deals in politics. And I think this is a guy who has honed his strategy for, 40 years or so during his career. And he's even written about how he makes these deals in The Art of the Deal. He talks about making your opponent, belittling your opponent and sort of trying to gain the upper hand. Well, that doesn't work in Washington, D.C., where your opponent, in this case, at least according to the president, is somebody like Mitch McConnell, who's actually on your own side. When you're insulting him, I mean, that's not how politics works, and that's not how deals get done in Washington. It turns out that business deals and political deals are very different, and it's clear that this president hasn't quite figured out how to operate those political deals just yet.
The president spoke last week about tax reform or changing our tax system. I think he had one page that he was working off of. Reid, if I can go back to you, is there more meat on the bones when it comes to any kind of changes in our tax system?
There are discussions happening on Capitol Hill about how to operate some kind of tax reform plan. I think what we've seen over the last year or so is that that has gone from a grand reform plan like we saw in the Reagan administration to a much smaller, more focused kind of really tax cut plan for certain Americans. And by the way, for corporate taxes as well, and some effort to allow onshoring of the corporate profits that are being kept overseas. That being said, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who works closely with the House Ways and Means Committee. They are not convinced that any kind of actual proposal is forthcoming. You know, this is still an idea that exists on one piece of paper, when in fact reforming the tax code is a massive undertaking. You know, people talk about how big the tax code is. Well, it takes a big bill to reduce that tax code over the long run. I'm not sure Congress is anywhere near even a plan, much less a consensus to get to that plan.
Do deficits matter? I think, was it Vice President Dick Cheney said that they didn't. Do they matter, Reid?
That is something that is going to be up to the House Ways and Means Committee and to Republicans at large. I mean, are they, which do they prioritize here? Do they prioritize actually getting a tax cut, actually passing something big in the first year of total Republican control of government, or do they stick to the principles that they held to when President Obama was in office? One thinks that they're probably more eager to actually get things done. Look, think about a year of Congress like a hockey game. Like, there are three periods, right? There's you get sworn in through about the Easter recess. That's when you get to sort of set the table, set your agenda. The second period is between the Easter recess and the August recess, when you start passing things. You know, that was when cap and trade passed the House and an Affordable Care Act, a version of it, the very early version, passed the House under President Obama's first year. And then you've got the third period when the sort of your back is against the wall and you've got to pass as many things as possible that happen from August through the end of the year. Hmm. Well, we're through two periods of this Republican first year in Congress, and nothing's actually happened. Nothing big has passed Congress. They're really it's up to them now to actually get something done. And they're starting off this third period with must-pass bills like the debt ceiling, like Harvey Aid, like funding for FEMA and actually funding the government and keeping it open. They are really running out of time to get something done, given the fact that we don't even have some kind of measure to debate on taxes. That tells me that we're probably not going to get to it this year. And by the way, getting it to it next year, getting something done in an election year is really difficult.
Rosie, where do things stand with the Mueller investigation? And I'm just thinking back over the last couple of months, it's been a pretty consequential summer when it comes to either the Mueller investigation or certainly the two congressional committees that are looking into Russian collusion in the presidential race. Where do things stand, and how much do you think that affects the White House and President Trump himself, what he says, what he does?
Well, as far as the investigation itself, obviously things have sort of come out bit by bit in the media over the last couple of months that indicate that Mueller is sort of ramping up the investigation. He handled a grand jury. They, conducted a pre-dawn raid on Paul Manafort's house to obtain documents that he has. It just came out the other day that they are working with Eric Schneiderman on certain things. And so, you know, obviously, you know, the leaks that have come out of it have indicated that it's sort of, you know, it's continuing apace. I mean, it seems to be sort of picking up. In terms of how it affects President Trump, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, this thing has been a huge distraction and source of concern inside the White House, you know, since it got going. And I think, you know, something that the White House aides have struggled with is trying to keep President Trump focused on, you know, the agenda and the things that he's kind of supposed to be doing, as opposed to sort of stewing about the Mueller investigation and being kind of distracted and angry about it.
Reid, I'm curious about these congressional committees that are doing their parallel investigations. They don't get as much attention, I think, as the Mueller investigation. What's the status there?
Well, a couple of members of Congress, Eric Swalwell, a Democrat from California who's on the Intelligence Committee, and some others said over the weekend that essentially they had a pretty good August, and they are getting stuff done, and they expect to continue a pace in September. Their focus, as I understand it, is more on Russian efforts to influence the 2016 election and to potentially hack into some of our election systems around the country. So I think that effort is probably less likely to lead to something that implicates the president himself and more likely to sort of shine a spotlight on the problems that need to be solved before we get to the next election system. And by the way, fixing American elections is a really daunting task.
Sure.
Because the power to hold elections is not a federal thing. The federal government has very little authority over how states run their elections. The Constitution gives all the power to state legislatures and state governments about how they hold their elections, how they register people to vote, et cetera, et cetera. That's why you see some states implementing, you know, hardcore voter ID laws and other states going for automatic voter registration, on the other hand. So the fact is, it's not just Congress that has to do something to fix these systems. It's the state governments themselves, and in some cases, they're operating systems that are decades old.
I'm curious to you, Rosie, thinking about the president and the White House. Secretary of State Tillerson. I was on vacation last week, so I'm getting a little rusty here. Tillerson was interviewed on Fox News saying, asking about values and American values and his values, and saying essentially the president speaks for himself, rather dismissive of the president. Is Tillerson in any way looking for an exit out of the White House from your reporting or for what you know?
I mean, from what I understand, there's, you know, a decent amount of tension between Secretary Tillerson and the president. And Tillerson's attempt to sort of distance himself from the president in that Fox News appearance, obviously, I don't think went over very well. In terms of, like, whether he's going to be sort of imminently fired, I have not heard anything to that effect. I think generally the feeling is that, Tillerson is certainly, you know, probably not going to be serving for Trump's entire first term, obviously, mm-hmm. but there's no imminent plans to leave, but that he might, you know, be putting in maybe for the rest of the year or something to that effect.
Reid, we're almost out of time here. How many days is Congress then in session until the end of the year? It's sort of like dog years, right? It's like,
yeah, until the end of the year, I'm going to have a problem with that. But I mean, as we look forward to just the deadlines that are coming up, they're going to be in what, 3 or 4 days this week, and then 3 or 4 next week. We're really looking at about 12 legislative days before we hit either a debt ceiling or a government shutdown, unless they act.
And that's Reid Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. Reid, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
You got it, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Rosie Gray, White House correspondent for The Atlantic. Rosie, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And let me read an email from Lynn. Just we can't squeeze this in except for having me read it here. People are missing the point of ending DACA. We need to send a message to people coming into this country illegally that their children cannot be used as tools to help them unfairly game the immigration system. These young people are victims of their parents' decision to come here illegally. That said, they have benefited enormously from years, even decades, of American taxpayer-funded education and health care. They have little to complain about. I'm constantly astonished by the degree the U.S. immigration policy is being dictated by non-citizens. Well, that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program. Many thanks to Mary Cummings Jordan for hosting last week so I could go on vacation with my family. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.